I have not seen anything that would cause me to change my position, but I never say never because there may be new information.
Republican uncertainty the day before a Senate hearing on opening ANWR. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new company buys into a promising oil discovery near Prudhoe.
They've never operated in Alaska before or on the North Slope, and so that definitely took us by surprise.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Thinking about completing your college degree? Good news, you can finish it right here at the University of Alaska. Go after your dream by earning a bachelor's, master's, a certificate, or an associate degree at the University of Alaska. Flexible classes, convenient schedules, affordable choices, and outstanding faculty, the university has it all. It's your choice, your dream. See how the University of Alaska can help you achieve it at alaska.edu/start here. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
For decades, environmental groups warned that big oil would plunder the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge if Congress opened the area to drilling. Tomorrow, the U.S. Senate will hold a hearing on whether to allow drilling in the refuge as part of the Republican tax plan. And now the environmental argument has shifted. A report commissioned by the Alaska Wilderness League claims drilling advocates are exaggerating industry's interest in the refuge. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
The budget plan Congress passed last month calls on the Senate Energy Committee to come up with $1 billion in federal revenues over the next decade. Senator Lisa Murkowski chairs that committee, and she says allowing lease sales in the refuge is the best way to fulfill the directive. But David Murphy of St. Lawrence University in New York says that's unlikely.
The idea that we could raise $1 billion from bonus bids seems to be outlandishly high.
Murphy, an assistant professor of environmental studies, says oil companies would have to lease every single one of roughly 1.5 million acres along the coast of the refuge for more than $1,300 apiece, which he says would be unprecedented.
The average over the past two decades for the entire North Slope is $34. Okay, so you're talking two orders of magnitude difference.
$34 an acre compared to $1,300 an acre. And that assumes the revenue would be split 50-50 between the state and the feds, as prior bills have proposed, rather than the 90-10 split promised to Alaska in the statehood compact. Ultimately, it will be up to the Congressional Budget Office to calculate whether Murkowski's ANWR legislation reaches the $1 billion mark, as the budget calls for. The more important sum might be 51, the number of votes it takes to pass a budget bill of this type under Senate rules. Democrats tried to remove ANWR from the budget last month, but got only 48 votes. It's not obvious how the math would be any different if the Senate votes again on it as part of a tax package.
Well, the first strategy is defeat the tax package.
Anti-drilling Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico says Democrats plan a multi-pronged approach.
We think we have the potential with such a close vote to change some minds.
One senator to watch is Republican Susan Collins of Maine. She was the only Republican to side with Democrats in last month's ANWR vote. Republican leaders are said to be debating changes to their tax plan to pick up moderates like her. Collins has been a consistent vote against drilling in the refuge throughout her career. But she and Murkowski are allies on issues like health care and funding for Planned Parenthood. And Collins said she was keeping an open mind ahead of the Energy Committee's hearing on ANWR.
Right now, I have not seen anything that would cause me to change my position, but I never say never because there may be new information.
Murkowski has Alaskans lined up to discuss the benefits of drilling in ANWR at the hearing. They include every statewide elected office holder, herself, her Senate colleague, and Congressman Don Young, as well as the governor and the lieutenant governor. Other witnesses include Tribal Administrator Matthew Rexford of Kuktovik, Fairbanks-based Doyon CEO Aaron Schutt, and Arctic Slope Regional Corporation Vice President Richard Glenn. Other Alaskans will testify against drilling. They include Lois Epstein of the Wilderness Society and Gwich'in tribal member Samuel Alexander. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
One of the most promising oil discoveries on the North Slope is getting a new owner. Armstrong Energy is selling off a significant chunk of its stake in the Nanushuk oil play to Oil Search, a company based in Papua New Guinea. Oil Search announced today it will take over as operator next summer. Estimated at more than 1 billion barrels, Nanushuk could be one of the biggest future oil developments in Alaska. It's on state land west of Prudhoe Bay. If developed, the companies think it could produce up to 120,000 barrels per day, nearly a quarter of what's currently flowing down the Trans-Alaska pipeline. Allison Walters, an analyst with Wood McKinsey in Houston, says it isn't a surprising move from Armstrong.
It has been Armstrong's business model to explore, prove up discoveries, and then sell them to new operators on the North Slope.
But Walter says Oil Search is an unexpected buyer. Oil Search's biggest investments are in liquefied natural gas projects in its home country.
And they've never operated in Alaska before or on the North Slope. And so that definitely took us by surprise.
The company's connection to Alaska is through Repsol, a Spanish oil company it partners with in Papua New Guinea. Repsol also owns a stake in the Nanushuk play. Oil Search aims to start producing oil by 2023. But because the company is new to the challenges of working in Alaska, Walter says it could take longer for the oil project to get up and running. Five inmates in an Alaska Department of Corrections prison overdosed on opioids in one 24-hour period. According to DOC, the overdoses happened at the Highland Mountain Correction Center from Monday through Tuesday night. All five women are expected to survive, and as Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove reports, DOC officials credit a rapid response administering the overdose-reversing drug Narcan.
DOC says the first woman overdosed Monday night, followed by four more Tuesday night at Highland, the state's lone correctional facility dedicated to housing female inmates. Ever since Governor Bill Walker declared a state opioid disaster in February, corrections staff have been getting more training on how to deal with overdoses. DOC spokesperson Megan Edge says that while drug overdoses occur from time to time in state correctional facilities, a cluster of five in a single day is uncommon.
The reality is we are in the middle of an opioid epidemic, and prisons aren't immune to that.
Edge says DOC's professional conduct unit is investigating questions like how the drugs got into Highland and whether the substance was heroin, prescription pills, or a powerful synthetic opioid like fentanyl. Still, she says, drugs are routinely sneaked into prisons and jails. And so correctional officers and nurses at the facilities are trained on what to do to save prisoners from an overdose, especially as they see more and more people addicted to opioids coming through their doors.
And so they're constantly looking for more tools and resources that they can use in those situations. I mean, DOC is the largest substance abuse treatment provider in the state. And so that means that we need the tools and resources to do it.
That includes distributing emergency kits that include doses of Narcan at correctional centers and probation offices around the state. Edge says the kits were installed as a result of policy measures that kicked in after Walker's formal disaster declaration. In Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
Edge says responding paramedics used Narcan to revive the first woman who overdosed. DOC staff are credited with administering the drug to reverse the four subsequent overdoses. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, learning the finer points of reindeer herding.
Well, the hardest part was probably in the beginning because I let them out and chased them around for 8 hours all over the place.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of operations in Alaska.
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
And by
GCI Business with complete GCI data solutions for Alaska's most important organizations. GCI is your partner in possibilities.
The open enrollment period for the individual health insurance market opened today. A news release from the director of the Division of Insurance, Lori Wing Heyer, says Alaska's open enrollment period will run until December 15th, shortened from 3 months to just 6 weeks this year. Wing Heyer states Alaska's individual health insurance market started to stabilize in 2017, and she encourages Alaskans who may have found plans too expensive last year to take a look at this year's plans. She says Alaska's reinsurance program has helped lower rates by 20%. There are five plans to choose from for 2018, and many Alaskans qualify for federal tax credits to help offset the cost. A Fairbanks man is charged with fatally stabbing another man on the city's east side last night. FPD reports that 26-year-old Sheldon Wolf stabbed 40-year-old Armagan Idle during a fight in a parking lot near the intersection of the Old Steese Highway and College Road. Police spokeswoman Yumi McCulloch says Wolf, who is charged with second-degree murder, told police Idle started the fight.
Wolf stated to police that he and his friend were walking north on Old Steese Highway and were confronted by Idle. Idle yelled at Wolf's friend and struck him in the back of the head with some type of cylindrical weapon. Wolf got between the two and Idle struck Wolf on the left side of his face. Wolf produced a butterfly-style knife and stabbed Idle somewhere in the left shoulder.
McCulloch says police followed Wolf's footprints from where Idle's body was found to an apartment building where they took him into custody.
The fresh snow really helped out, and so they were able to track those footprints.
McCulloch says Wolf told police he threw the knife used in the stabbing in the Tanana River before officers located him at the apartment. It's the eighth murder in the city so far this year, topping the seven homicides which occurred in Fairbanks last year. Other peak years include 2012, when there were five murders, and 2014, when there were four. Following months of intense public criticism, Unalaska's mayor is now facing a recall effort. Frank Kelty has denied allegations that he interfered with the former city manager or forced his resignation. But as KUCB's Laura Craigle reports, the recall petition isn't centered on recent clashes at City Hall. Instead, it accuses the mayor of backroom dealings regarding the city dock.
The recall petition charges Mayor Frank Kelty with one count of misconduct, attempting to sole source land use agreements for the Unalaska Marine Center positions 5 through 7. In other words, Kelty is accused of giving one company an unfair first crack at a preferential use agreement, rather than letting the city open a public bidding process as required by municipal code. But the mayor says it's not true.
Totally false. Everyone knows that the city manager handles negotiations on things like that.
Recently, however, the trajectory of those negotiations has been unclear. Since the city reopened a long-standing debate on dock usage, the city manager has resigned and half the city council has been voted out of office. The council has also revoked its own directive authorizing negotiations after receiving legal advice from the city attorney, and the matter has not gone out to bid. Kelty has been a vocal supporter of renewing Matson's lapse contract, and he admits to meeting with the private shipping company. But the mayor says those meetings are part of an ongoing working relationship, not evidence of an illegal deal.
Naturally, I would take a meeting with Matson, who is a major revenue producer for the city and provides jobs, talk to them and hear their concerns. But I've been in no meetings when there was negotiations going on.
KUCB has filed a public records request for the mayor's emails regarding dock agreements, but Kelty says the effort to recall him from office is really about something else.
I think it's carryover from the Martinson issue.
Dave Martinson resigned as city manager in September, citing long-term tension with the council and mayor. The Unalaskans leading the recall push acknowledge that is a factor. Ryan Burke is the petition's primary contact.
The public, in my opinion, has lost faith in the mayor in general. All of this stemming, obviously, from the departure of Dave Martinson. His relationship with the mayor kind of crumbled his wanting to stay here.
Burke says he and 9 co-sponsors are now circulating petitions around the island. They have until December 22nd to gather 168 signatures.
We're getting there. You know, we're all collecting these signatures to hopefully bring this to a vote here very soon.
If they succeed, City Clerk Margie Veeder will schedule a recall election no later than 75 days after signatures are verified. She says voters would be able to recall the mayor with a simple majority. In Unalaska, I'm Laura Craigle.
Life in Bristol Bay's villages is expensive, like much of rural Alaska. For Port Hyden residents, a gallon of shelf-stable milk costs more than $20. Fresh milk isn't available because it would take too long to ship. But they're working on improving their access to fresh foods by producing their own. KDLG's Avery Lill has more on Port Hyden's Mishik Farm.
Port Hyden's reindeer trot toward the door of their pen. No snorting or animal noises. It's no wonder they're Santa's animal of choice for a quick, stealthy trip around the world. 19-year-old Jake Carlson walks quietly behind them.
They're calm. You can see that they're calm. I think it's easy to tell when a reindeer's pretty stressed because you can see it in their eyes and the way they run. I just walk them. Some of the other people who work here, you really like to use the bikes to get them in, but they usually listen to what I want them to do.
Carlson works for the village as a farmer, putting in 4 or 5 hours a day, 7 days a week. In addition to the reindeer, he takes care of pigs, chickens, rabbits, and a cow. It's a job that he'll hold until he goes to college next year. The purpose of this farm is twofold: to provide fresh food and economic infrastructure. Adrienne Christensen is the native village of Port Hyden's director of business development.
The farm is one piece in our economic loop that we're building. We would like to be a sustainable village on our own and to be able to keep those dollars and jobs in our community. We have only 100 people, so if one person is employed, that's 1% of our community more that has a job.
Carlson's job is the primary one that the farm provides. A handful of other Port Hyden residents pick up hourly work taking care of the animals, and a few committed volunteers keep the place operational. The Alaska Peninsula has a rich history of animal husbandry. Reindeer herding was a popular trade in the area beginning in the early 1900s, but reindeer herding fell by the wayside with the rise of commercial fishing. Reindeer herding was over for Port Hyden by the 1950s. That is, until 29 reindeer were unloaded from charter planes in Port Hyden in 2015. The village decided to reestablish the tradition after steep declines in the wild caribou on the peninsula in the 1990s and early 2000s. Hunting was banned from 2005 to 2015. The caribou on the peninsula have now recovered enough for some hunting, but it's strictly limited.
We missed eating good food. We were having to order beef and pork and chicken. It's not good for our bodies, and we don't particularly like it. So we were sitting around one day really, really hungry, and we thought, well, we should become reindeer farmers. And so we did.
It's been a learning curve. Randy Stryker came to Alaska with the program Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms, or WOOF, 2 years ago. He helps on the farm in return for his room and board. He got to Port Hyden shortly after the reindeer did.
Well, the hardest part was probably in the beginning, because I let them out and chased them around for 8 hours all over the place. But then after the first month or so, we got down to where they were used to us, and it's become really easy. And then we can walk right beside them.
The main hurdle right now is numbers. The village doesn't want to harvest reindeer for meat until the herd is about 100 strong. The birth rate is good, but they've struggled with bear and wolf attacks.
We really do our best to keep them safe, but sometimes nature is more strong than electric fences.
Right now, the herd is stable with about 30 animals. In the meantime, their rabbits, chickens, and pigs are supplying the fresh food that the village craved.
We have huge shipping delays, so we've had people that never tasted a fresh chicken egg and didn't realize that chicken eggs could taste good.
At this point, the farm is not making money. It's funded primarily through donations and grants from organizations, including the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation and First Nations Development Institute. But the village is committed to seeing the project through. While the reindeer graze on the tundra during the day, elders keep an eye out for predators. Children pick fireweed during the summer to put away as feed for the winter. Together, the community is working to reestablish a sustainable food source and jobs to keep people and money in their village. In Port Hyden, I'm Avery Lill.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Open enrollment for the health insurance marketplace in Alaska is now through Friday, December 15th. Enrollment assistance is available and it's free. Visit getcoveredalaska.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Children's Trust. The Anchorage School District, the Girl Scouts of Alaska, and the University of Alaska's Robotics Club are hosting their annual Introduce a Girl to Engineering Day. Girls spend the day engaged in real-world experiments that explore the world of science, technology, engineering, and math. For more information on how you can get involved, visit girlscoutsofalaska.org or take the quiz at beanengineeralaska.com. This community message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil.
Even though the holidays are still a ways off, a few civilian elves in Anchorage are already busy assembling presents for soldiers deployed overseas. With thousands of Alaska-based troops stationed in Afghanistan, organizations are rushing to get everything from board games to beef jerky boxed and sent abroad ASAP. The Armed Services YMCA has been in Alaska since the 1940s, and part of its mission is filling in gaps between the military and service members, for example, holiday cheer.
Anything from home that just sparks a little bit of joy in your heart gives them relief.
Sarah Riffer heads the ASYMCA, which runs programs to support service members and their families. That includes Operation Frosty Warrior, which entails filling boxes with supplies that can be hard to come by while troops are deployed ahead of the winter holidays.
Playing cards, travel board games, anything like that, books.
Riffer says for soldiers based in Alaska, many of whom have family members living here, tokens of home can be a boost. Hometown newspapers, smoked salmon, and jerky, for example. Riffer's organization partners with BP to collect money and supplies. Boxes have to be packed and palletized before November 22nd in order to make it to their final destinations around the globe. In a given year, around 1,000 Alaska soldiers are deployed overseas, but this year, with the 4th Brigade Combat Team 25th Infantry Division on a combat deployment in Afghanistan, that number is significantly higher.
3,100 this year. This is the largest deployment in the 7 years that this program has been going on, which is why we're reaching out to the community because we really need everyone's help to make sure that we do send 3,100.
ASYMCA Alaska is collecting money or will pick up boxes and supplies from individuals and participating organizations. You can find details and a wish list on the Alaska Armed Services YMCA website. A dog cafe, apparently the first one in Alaska, celebrated its official opening last weekend in Ketchikan. The cafe offers gourmet dog treats and an enclosed play yard. There's also coffee and treats for humans. KRBD's Layla Carey took her dogs to the new business to check it out.
As her three dogs run around the good-sized play yard, Gretchen Moore gets ready to open My Best Friend's Place for the day. It's a coffee shop, but dogs shouldn't drink coffee, so that one part is for people. The rest of the business is all about the dogs. Moore sits down briefly to talk about how she got the idea for a dog cafe.
I was in Seattle, and we were at a hotel, and out the window we watched dogs and people go into a coffee shop and get their coffee and then come out of the coffee shop and go down the street like a half a block and go into a dog park and just have fun. So I thought maybe Ketchikan needed something cool.
Work started in November of last year, picked up this spring, and is not quite finished. There are a few items that still need some work. The whole complex includes a retail pet store, a self-serve dog bathing area, and of course, the dog cafe. Moore says the coffee shop works with health codes because all the human beverages and wrapped snacks are self-serve.
We don't serve you. We will serve your dog, though. One of the most popular treats we have is the pumpkin peppuccinos. So they're super cute, and 99% of the dogs love them.
So people bring their dogs, get some coffee, maybe a treat for their dog, and then they can stay in the cafe with their dog. If the canine is feeling energetic, though, they can go out with their human into the play yard. Moore says they'll work with dog owners who have anxious or aggressive dogs as well.
You can come in here with that dog, and we'll give you your time in here to let your dog run and play. So it's a nice opportunity for people that are working very hard to socialize or rehabilitate a dog.
Moore also heads up BARC, a nonprofit animal rescue organization. It started about 3 years ago and also operates out of the new location. Before this new venture, Moore's business was centered at Groomingdale's boarding kennel. That location also housed a small retail space and the rescue operation. Only the boarding kennel remains at that North Tongass Highway site. The rest of the business is now inside city limits close to Walmart. Moore takes me around the new facility, which will include a cat cafe, the Litter Box Lodge. That's where people will be able to sit and drink coffee with BARC's adoptable feline guests. But that's not open yet.
We set it up, but it was just sort of a quick setup, and I didn't like it. So I'm changing it, so we're not going to go in there.
There aren't any cats in there anyway, because three were adopted the previous day.
So this is the self-bathing room. And you can just come in.
This room is of particular interest to me. I have a large dog with a tendency to roll joyfully in dead fish. The tub is at waist level, and Moore says they'll help a person find the right shampoo for their dog's needs. They also have blowers to dry the dog after its bath. The new larger retail space has all the items one would expect, including a rather zen-like room dedicated to tropical fish and reptiles. After the tour, I get my two dogs out of the car and turn them loose in the play yard with Moore's dogs, just to test it. It passed the test. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Harbaugh, Zachariah Hughes, and Casey Grove in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Laura Craigle in Unalaska, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Colder temperatures are here, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you of the danger of carbon monoxide, a poisonous gas that you can't see or smell. If it builds up in your home, it can be deadly. Be safe this winter and have a qualified mechanic ensure your heating system is working properly. Never run your car in the garage or operate a portable generator in an enclosed space. Finally, always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This message sponsored by AHFC. Do you need health insurance for next year? Did you know Alaska's individual market health insurance rates have dropped by more than 20% for 2018? More than 90% of Alaskans who sign up at healthcare.gov are eligible for tax credits to help pay the costs. Open enrollment is November 1st through December 15th of this year. Check out healthcare.gov to find out what your insurance options are for 2018. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.